Native Americans. Their names are all around us, and most of us have a vague notion of who these people are. Or do we? In speaking of Native Americans, Allison Owings, in her conversation with Rosemary Manchester, says, a lot of these people are not on reservations. Owings' curiosity about what she didn't know and understand about the Native people of our continent led her to talk with and listen to a spectrum of Native Americans. I'm Suzanne Lang, and you're listening to A Novel Idea. Rosemary Manchester speaks with Allison Owings about her most recent book, Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans. But first, let's hear the conversation Rosemary had with Chuck Kensler about Owings' book. Kensler is a vintner and an author who you've heard on this program before, and he is a Lakota Sioux. We'll also hear from Vicki Reno, who spent time teaching on a Navajo reservation during the 60s, on the cusp of the Native American militancy of the 60s and 70s. So stay tuned. It's a novel idea.
Chuck Kensler is my source on all things concerning Native Americans. Chuck, it's such a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Nice seeing you, Rosemary. Thanks for inviting me. It's very nice.
How'd the book strike you?
First of all, I just love the picture on the cover.
Oh, yes.
Many times you'll see pictures of Native American people, or I call them American Indians, and they've always got this poor look about them, like they're trying to get out of a enclosure, you know, some kind of a cyclone fence. And they have these poor eyes, and they're looking so sad. And those pictures are probably true. But this photograph on the front of the book, it's in color, and it's of several Nez Perce Indians. I believe they're called Looking Glass Tribe. And what is wonderful about it, it's adults and children, and they're all laughing. They have on everything from beaded moccasins to their hair being braided. A lot of them have dark glasses on, but the biggest surprise is the smiles, and it's just wonderful to see that. And they're wrapped up in Pendleton blankets, which makes it very colorful.
Oh, it's a beautiful picture.
Isn't
I wanted
wonderful?
To be up there with them. I wanted to know what they were laughing about.
I don't know. It's probably some in-joke.
I'm sure, yes.
You know, that someone is not good enough looking, and or maybe they all don't want to look like a certain person because they don't think that person's the best-looking one.
There's a lot in the book about jokes and humor. And particularly in jokes and that sort of thing. I loved that.
In Indian jokes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, they Indians really go with a lot of humor.
Yes.
I'm a Lakota. That's a new name for the Sioux. There's three kinds of Sioux now, and it's their language groups. There's Lakota, which is the largest group of Sioux. And then next are the Dakota and the Nakota. And they all speak the same language, but with a little bit different dialect and pronunciations. Not only that, it's the same word pronounced in a little bit different way for the women. It'd be much like having an A ending in Spanish and an O ending in Spanish. So you know who's speaking. You get the gender there. So the women, when speaking to the men, would have a different pronunciation of the same word. Carrying that a little bit further into the humor, my father always used to laugh about this because there's so many families that have no men in the families. The men go off to war or just walk off. And these kids that are learning the Sioux, the Lakota, Nakota, or the Lakota language are learning it with women accents. So a boy will get up to speak after he's a man. He'll get up to speak, and he's got the women's dialect. And the old-timers know this, but the kid doesn't. So it, yeah, that's humor, and they would just kind of shake their heads and say, "Well, what is that Winky doing?" Because a Winky is a gay man, and they're very honored people in the Sioux society. Gay men would be a person, the Winky would be a person who would often ride a horse into battle, riding it backward. And he might not participate in the battle, but he's like the flag. And it just shows how brave he is to go into battle riding his horse backward. He does everything backward. He wears his clothes backward. He walks backward. If you have a baby, it's always good to have a Winky bless your baby. It brings good luck. So that's why he's out in the lead in battle. So they always make a joke about the dialect now that the Sioux are speaking. So that was a long answer. I'm sorry
that. But that was, it was, you know, all new information to me and very interesting. I've heard you read some of the stories about your dad. Mm-hmm. And as I recall, he went to Haskell Institute in Kansas.
That's right.
And there's quite a bit in the book about Haskell. And I wondered if you would add a bit of your own story and your dad's story about his experiences at boarding school.
I could add something there, yes. Haskell started off, and I don't have any dates in my head now, but it'd be in the late 1800s, about 6 years after Carlisle University was established. And I think it was called Carlisle Institute. And it was established by a military man. His last name is Pratt. I think his first name is Jim. And he said that he could take care of the Indian situation, the Indian problem, whatever that is, by training Indians like he trained soldiers. So Carlisle was set up as the first off-site, off-state, off-home boarding school. And Indians from all over the United States would go to Carlisle. And that's in Pennsylvania.
Ah.
Then the next school that was set up by Pratt was Haskell Institute, and it took Indians from all over the United States also. And the kids were, their hair was cut, their clothes were changed to military uniforms, and they learned to march, get up at 5:30 in the morning at a reveille, and go to school for half a day and then chores the rest of the day and do soldiering, marching, and that kind of thing.
How old was your dad when he went to boarding school?
My father had been to what they call a mission school in South Dakota, and he had gone to a year to a mission school. And the mission school was set up so that he could go back home at the end of the day. Haskell was set up as a boarding school, mm-hmm. So you went off to Haskell. He was born in 1910, and in 1916, so he was just six or going on seven,
just
he went
child.
Off to Haskell.
Just a little
just
child.
Just a little guy.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
As an adult, he used to tell stories about other kids coming to Haskell when he was older. He'd been there a few years by this time, and he had picked up other Native American tongues that he could speak some words. And he always talks about this poor little Apache kid that came in on a train and got off in Lawrence, Kansas at the train station. And the kid just didn't know what was happening. You know, he was little. He was scared. He had on one shoe. Of course, he was crying. And he just didn't understand what was happening. And I think that must have gone on for many, many of those students that left home. And you might be there a year. I think my father went home after his second year in school. Your parents, they didn't encourage parents to come to school to visit you. They didn't encourage you to go home because they were trying to assimilate you into a white society. And it was better that they didn't speak their tongue. They weren't allowed to speak any Indian tongues in school. although they said that's how they learned to speak with other Indians, and they came out with common languages, and they came out having a pretty strong society, that underground thing that happens.
It's just heartbreaking to think of those little children. What a terrible, terrible experience for those children.
It couldn't have been good. I visited Haskell a few years ago, mm-hmm. and it was on the majestic side. I just thought it was beautiful. Old limestone buildings, and there was a lot of new buildings, which means that Haskell has gone from essentially a high school, an industrial high school, and now it's called Haskell Indian Nations University.
Hmm.
And they're adding a lot of new brick buildings that are modern buildings or dormitories and auditoriums and that kind of thing.
Isn't that a wonderful transformation?
It really is.
This place that had such sadness and sorrow for the children has now been turned into a place of hope and promise for them.
But there was a lot of kids also, even though Haskell was this school that was giving an education, sometimes it didn't agree with some kids, and kids would run away.
Yes.
And they would be caught and punished.
Punished, yes.
And they would be severely punished, you know, more than you should be punished. So.
Yes.
Anyway, my father always said, you know, it gave him an education, and it got him started in the world. And he always liked saluting. He was never in the military, but he always liked saluting.
What other things in the Allison Owings writings particularly impressed you or caught your attention?
I think right in the very beginning on page one, she says, let me start out with my own ignorance. And she is driving in the Southwest in a car. She comes to a sign at the beginning of this trip, and the sign is at one of the borders of a reservation, and it says, "You are entering the Navajo Nation." And at this point, she didn't know whether she should drive in there or report herself or what. But even as a Native American, I've had that same feeling when I'm in Arizona or going on. I remember working on a Jicarilla Apache reservation in New Mexico, and feeling very foreign there. And I didn't look like a Jicarilla Apache, I know that. Mm-hmm. But I felt like I was trespassing. You know, am I doing the right thing? Am I walking on the right side of the street? Am I being polite in the right way?
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone who can start her book out by confessing her ignorance, she won my heart immediately.
I think what I really like, too, is on the very first page, I came across the word teepee, and she brings it up. She says a teepee, and she spells it T-E-E-P-E-E. Well, I looked at the word, and I said, well, that's not how the Sioux spell teepee, because teepee is a Sioux word, and it's T-I-P-I. So I go to the dictionary, and the preferred spelling is T-E-P-E-E. But she hit it closer than I did because she spelled it T-E-E, two E's, P-E-E. And then the third preferred use of the word was T-I-P-I, even though it was a Sioux word.
Mm-hmm.
And then they gave the definition. I just love this. They called a teepee a tent or a wigwam of the American Indian. So right there, we've got teepee, 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 wigwam, and a tent. So now we've got five spellings of one object. And Indians are always so critical of the English language.
Yes. And throughout the book, there was this thread that ran through it that the people in Washington knew what was best for the American Indians. And it was so obvious that they didn't have a clue.
They had no clue.
And they just kept insisting that they knew best. Are things better?
I think things are better. One of the people in the book, I don't remember her name right now, but she's an Osage Indian, mm-hmm. and she's a lawyer.
Yeah.
I think her last name is Homer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she's a lawyer in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I know of one other lady. She's a Dine from Arizona that's a lawyer in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And she's tough, let me tell you. They know Indian law, and they're able to defend it.
To me, every time I came to a new chapter, it was like a door opened.
Wasn't that something?
And I met a new person and learned
a new person.
So much.
As soon as I looked and I saw that this was a Caucasian lady that had written this book, I thought, well, what does she know about writing about Indians?
Right.
And I've been proven wrong so many times. I just finished reading a book called Empire of the Summer Moon by a man named S.C. Gwynne, G-W-Y-N-N-E, and it's about Quanta Parker and the rise and fall of the Comanches. And he says they're the most powerful Indian tribe in American history. And it was so fascinating, and there must have been 30 pages of references.
It's been very well reviewed.
It's just a tremendous book.
Yes.
I just appreciate this man so much.
Mm-hmm.
And he's certainly a Caucasian writer. One other book, I should mention this. I've never mentioned this to anyone, I don't think, is a little-known book written by a white man. And the name of it is You Are Respectfully Invited to Attend My Execution. And his name is Larry K. Brown. And chapter 2 is titled Killer at 6 Mile. And it's about the capture, trial, and hanging of my great-great-grandfather, William Toussaint Kensler. And he was the second person to legally be executed in the Wyoming Territory. And the hanging took place in November 19th, 1874.
Now, did I understand you correctly that that was your great-great-grandfather?
That's my great-great-grandfather,
amazing.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes. And I thought that was done very well. But those are what I call white writers writing about Indians. And I have so much respect for this author on the book we're talking about tonight because it's done so well. And
I'm so happy to hear it.
That was Chuck Kensler talking with Rosemary Manchester about Allison Owings' latest book, Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans. Allison and Rosemary follow some of those threads brought up by Chuck, and we'll listen to their conversation in a few minutes. But first, let's hear from Vicki Reno. Reno descends from the Mohawks of New York State, and after graduating from college, she went to teach school on a Navajo reservation in eastern Arizona.
I was there as a brand new teacher in the year 1965, and I taught at a boarding school in a very remote part of the Navajo reservation, little community called Lukachukai. So it was the Lukachukai boarding school, all Bureau of Indian Affairs, and it was the far northeast corner of Arizona. I taught first grade. I was all excited, brand new teacher, all my teaching methods new in my head, and there I was and watching for the students to come in. Most of them came in on buckboards, horse and wagon. A few came in pickups, but they came from 20, 30 miles away. And those kids, those little first graders and all the rest of the students, they didn't see their parents again till Christmas. So it was a difficult thing. I mean, fortunately, I was very fortunate that I had the younger children. The older children, I was appalled at the treatment they were getting from the Bureau and from the teachers. The thing that struck me was just the whole attitude of taking any dignity of being Navajo out of them. They weren't allowed to speak Navajo. In a sense, the Bureau wanted to turn them into the white man. One specific example would be, I didn't witness this, but when the teachers would get together for lunch, some of the junior high teachers would tell me that just for one word in Navajo, they had to kneel on rice for, you know, half an hour, 40 minutes as a punishment. And I couldn't believe that. It was beyond my comprehension. And they said that the kids didn't talk, they didn't emote. So that stereotype of the stoic Indian, a lot, I think, has to do with how they were treated. They didn't say anything after a while because of the fear they put in them. But I believe fervently in allowing children to speak in their own native language. And so I did allow that, and it was frowned upon. I didn't follow the Bureau regime very well. The great thing that happened to us the next year, through President Johnson, then with his war on poverty and the Office of Economic Opportunity, the Rough Rock Demonstration School was born. So that was in 66, and we were lucky enough to be hired there, become a part of that school, and a completely different situation. There was an all Navajo school board. Kids were taught in their native language. Their tribal culture was taught through community people. They had all kinds of wonderful programs. So it was a different community, a brand new school, and that was something that I will always treasure. Sergeant Shriver came to visit us there. We had Vista volunteers. It was really, really wonderful. Anyway, I think that, you know, when you're 21, 22, you don't realize what you have until you reflect back on it when you're older and you look back. And like to be able to sit, I was sitting next to Sergeant Shriver in a hogan eating mutton stew. And I didn't think it was, I thought it was okay. I didn't think it was that great. And then I gave him a ring to give his wife, Eunice Kennedy, and she wrote me a letter back and told me how wonderful and thank you so much. When Sergeant Shriver came, he brought some of the Kennedy boys with him, and they stayed in our trailer. I mean, these things, looking back on, I will always treasure. It gave me a great time for reflection, even at a young age, that what is life all about? You're sitting out there looking at the sunset. Beautiful country, really beautiful country. And all the people there taught me a lot. I'll always remember their tradition, how they, their care of the earth, their respect for, you know, nature has stayed with me all these years.
That was Vicki Reno recounting her days teaching and living with the Navajo. As Allison Owings says, it's a case of respect and acknowledgement. And I think Vicki Reno agrees. Before we get to Rosemary's conversation with Allison, let's listen to Owings' reading from the opening of her book, Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans.
Let me start with my own ignorance. While driving in rural Arizona for the first time, a road sign shocked me so much I did not know whether to brake, turn around, or look for a toll booth. As I recall, the sign read, "You are entering the Navajo Nation." "I am," I thought. "Nobody is stopping me. I'm allowed." Ever since childhood, I had felt American to my core, almost primevally American. But for the first time within these United States, I felt intrusive. After stopping to look at my map and realizing that to turn back was unwise, I drove on into, then eventually out of, the Navajo Nation. Later, taking stock of my ignorance, I tried to equate it with innocence. As a non-native New Jersey school child, far from known native influences, my education on the subject was cursory. Pocahontas was heroic. A scout could walk down a trail silently, and Indians used every part of a buffalo. Not always, I later learned. From school girlhood to the Navajo reservation sign, I was all but nativeless in consciousness, but for a few things I can point to. One is an eighth-grade report I unearthed titled White Man, spelled out with rifles and bullets, versus Indian, spelled out with bows and arrows. In one corner of the cover, a smiling Indian stands by an intact teepee, spelled T-E-E-P-E-E, then. Beside him is a frowning pilgrim, his home burned to the ground, before I labeled that. In the opposite corner, I had drawn a coonskin-hatted Davy Crockett-type man smiling by his intact cabin, while a frowning Indian stands beside a smoldering teepee. After. The text, which my teacher critiqued as factually accurate and written in an easy style that I trust is yours, included this passage about white man versus Indian wars. The Indians, seemingly inferior, really had the best excuses, for why shouldn't they? On the last page, my pictorial summary went from, "This is the land the Great Spirit gave us before the Pale Faces came," to, "We take the Trail of Tears as the white man pushes west," and concluded, "Working at the arts of our fathers, we keep alive our Indian memories. Americans love happy endings." In my education effluvia, I also found a long-forgotten report I wrote as a college sophomore for an economics class, "The Economic Situation of the Contemporary American Indian." As embarrassing as my then contention that reservations should be terminated was realizing that I had entirely forgotten several basic historical facts I had so carefully typed upon Eaton's corrasible bond. The work, "Represents Thought," critiqued the professor, was written in prose properly labeled sophomoric. What American Indians have given us is immeasurable, and what we have done in return has little ethical justification. What good are such spurts of documentable and empathetic interest about Native Americana, however, if neither remained in my memory? Then came Arizona. It was the site of one of many research road trips I was making around the country for a book about American classism as revealed through waitressing. This trip resembled others, lots of driving, lots of voluble waitresses, except for the inadvertent detour through the Navajo Nation. Not only did I feel ignorant, but abashed. It so happened that I was on my way to find a waitress of the Tohono O'odham Nation in southern Arizona to interview. Obviously, I knew nothing of Native America, but I did know that when most people picture waitress, they do not picture a Native American. At least I could skew that stereotype. Then, during a stopover in Tucson, a staff member at a museum warned me that those people, the Tohono O'odham, will never talk to an outsider. Those people. Another stereotype beckoned. Within hours, during the post-lunch lull at a reservation cafe in Sells, a Tohono O'odham waitress was talking candidly to me about her work and recounting extremely personal information. Later, as I put together her story, omitting at her request and my regret much of that personal information and giving her a pseudonym, I romanticized her a bit. Her bearing alone dazzled me. In writing about her, I remembered various Native people going about their business at the cafe and along the streets of Sells. I remembered visiting a shop whose proprietor had gone to Stanford University, where she studied under a professor I knew. I remembered driving around the reservation to get a feel for it and seeing a lone tourist taking pictures of a woman making tortillas and the tortilla maker looking annoyed. I remembered watching Tohono O'odham employees at the tribal casino outside Tucson and being struck by their laughter amid a grim-seeming clientele. My limited views into their everyday lives made me wonder about their views from the inside out. What did they see? What did other Native people see?
You've been listening to Allison Owings reading from her book, Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans. After a short break, we'll hear Allison in conversation with Rosemary Manchester. It's a novel idea, and we'll be right back.
Moths and other sacred wings, butterflies and bees whisper, in breath of the wind, blessed ways, blessing way things. Dreams are the mind's streams, thought pictures of the spirit. There are dreams of the day. There are dreams of night. Thinking and dreaming are related. Dreams of the day, we make our own. Dreams of night, part of eternal stone. There are dream takers taking from dream worlds, taking dreams as a way of stealing thoughts, turning minds inside and out. Dream slavers want to change our connections to ourselves, mess with our dreams, make us unsure, unclear about right and wrong, feed our dreams and instincts to industrial profit machine. Difference between dream and fantasy, reality and illusion, center and no center. Dreams of the day keep our spirit alive, our creative mind, who we really are. With dreams we can create and heal. Follow our original purpose. Dreams are protection, good medicine, blessed way things. Sun and moon continue. We are all on one journey.
The author of three oral history-based books, the latest being Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans. Allison Owings is in conversation with Rosemary Manchester.
It's a beautiful book, Allison. The cover is so attractive. That group of Native American women laughing and in their beautiful, colorful clothes. It made me want to be part of that group. I wanted to find out, what's the joke? Let me in on this.
Okay. This is a group, actually, it's men and women. You might have been
Oh, I see.
You might have been distracted by all those braids, but those are men in the braids. And the joke is that they are laughing at the photographer about whose face is going to break the camera. And I have to say that I did fight for this cover because I wanted to show that Native Americans have a lot of humor in their lives. And this is one of the many stereotypes that non-natives, that nons have about them, that they're stoic and dour and they don't laugh. But they laugh a lot, and this shows that they do.
This cover was worth fighting for.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah. Now, this isn't your first book.
No.
By any means.
No. My first book is actually a silly book that none of the serious publishers would put on the inside jacket, and it's called The Wonder Woman's Phrase Book, How to Meet or Avoid People in Three Romance Languages, which was published by Shameless Hussy Press of Berkeley.
I'd buy that book.
that took about a half an hour to write, as opposed to the others that all took close to a decade.
Yes.
So the first serious book was called Frauen, German Women Recall the Third Reich. And that was followed by Hey Waitress, the USA from the Other Side of the Tray. And then this.
Yes. And this form that you use in going around and interviewing or talking with individual people and not generalizing or putting your own thoughts in, but just simply presenting them through the conversation that you have with them, I find it very effective.
Well, thank you. I think that, of course, everyone is an individual, and I'm very much drawn to people who are stereotyped and not seen as individuals. And this is the case in all three of my bigger books. And I knew that Native people were stereotyped terribly. Actually, this is the first time I decided to interview men as well as women.
Yes.
Because there was really no good reason not to. And I simply interviewed them and just let them talk.
Yes.
And talk and talk and talk. And then came the other work of putting together a profile. So each person, or basically each person, has his or her own chapter in the book.
And you've pulled off for me what seems to be the incredibly difficult job of being our ears and eyes and yet being unobtrusive. We are aware through your writing that you are the one who's recording the conversation, but you don't intrude yourself.
Oh, well, thank you. That was
That
was a big challenge, actually. And I always object to interviews that I see, whether on stage or here on radio or see on television, where the interviewer seems to think, well, I'm just as important as you are, and let me tell you all about myself. And the guest is really secondary. And I wanted very much to be in the background and keep myself out of it as much as I could. And I blame my writing group, which has been around a long time and has seen me through many of these chapters. They kept saying, we need more of you. We need more of you. We want to see these people and hear them through your eyes and through your ears. So I would reluctantly put a little more of myself in, but I really wanted to stay as much in the background as I could, because this is not a book called Conversations with Native Americans. It's Listening to Native Americans. I didn't want to share the stage, really. I wanted it to be their story and not mine.
Yeah. Well, as far as I'm concerned, you did a superb job of just that.
And you have to respect the reader to make his or her own judgments. This was very much the fact in my first big book, Frauen, German Women, Recall the Third Reich, where I would have the reader decide, do I believe this woman or not? Is she telling the truth or not? I didn't want to say, I think she's lying or I think she's not lying. So I really feel that people should be taken at their word, whether or not, in fact, that word is accurate or not, and let the reader decide. Now, sometimes I have to intrude a little bit if something is historically off or is a little suspect. I mean, there are different ways, sort of subtle ways of intruding of whether to say this is not borne out by newspaper accounts of the same story, or that sort of thing. But in general, I like the reader to decide what to think of this person they're reading about.
And you've chosen three groups of people that are as you say, stereotyped. You felt very strongly was unfair or...
This is true, although the first book, Frauen, German Women Recall the Third Reich, I started that thinking that I had my own stereotype about them. I wanted to believe in sort of a feminist way that German women were, so to speak, better than German men, and they'd all been great rescuers and they all hated Hitler. And the very first woman I interviewed started talking about the idealism of National Socialism. And I thought, whoop, I've got to change that. So in a way, I was de-stereotyping my own stereotype in talking about them and to them. So I tried to find as many German women from as many different backgrounds and as many different opinions as I could find.
Yes.
So it was an inadvertent foray into anti-stereotyping. The others were more deliberate.
Yes.
The waitresses I knew were stereotyped. Mm-hmm. Native people I knew were stereotyped. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have my own agenda that I had to change.
Right. You were not there as a missionary or an anthropologist.
Right.
You were there as a listener.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Wonderful. And you crossed the country from east to west.
When I started Indian Voices, I interviewed a few people who lived near me in California. Then I decided to take some further trips. And once I was launched, I went all over the place, somewhat directionlessly. I would find somebody who had agreed to talk with me. Then maybe I would do some editing of somebody else's books. That's my other rent payer, is to work as an editor and a freelance writer. And then I'd get some money together, and then I'd go and interview somebody here or there. It was not according to any kind of geographic plan. It had to do more with when it seemed like a good time to visit a certain place, whether there was a ceremony going on or whether it was accessible by road in the winter and that kind of thing.
How many years did it take to complete this work in this book?
Almost a decade.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had no idea it would take so long. I never have any idea that things are going to take as long as they do. But I found notes recently that I had taken in the fall of 2002, my initial ideas about writing the book. And my writing group remembers that I was talking about this and I think tried to dissuade me. They were smart.
Well, they might have been smart, but I'm glad they failed. Several things just spring off the page as you bring them up, and it seemed to me that they were common to most of the people that you talk to. And one of the most dreadful things is the sending the children away to school. And you have a wonderful story of when you first heard they went to boarding school, you thought, oh, I had no idea they went places like Phillips Andover. And then as the truth of the boarding school system came through from their stories, it's a terrible thing, isn't it?
It is terrible. And it's terrible to me that so few non-natives know about it. And this is something known to virtually every Native American, that there was a federally recognized and approved plan to rip Indian children from their homes from roughly the 1860s to about the 1930s and send them to boarding schools, government-run boarding schools. Sometimes the schools were run by religious orders, but in general they were government schools, and to quote-unquote civilize them. Oh. And this meant cut their hair, take off the clothes that they had come with, give them uniforms, forbid them to speak their language, forbid them to do anything that seemed native, and to be good Christians, more or less. Mm-hmm. And these children were sometimes thousands of miles away from home, and sometimes for years. And there were other kinds of schools. Some were day schools, and some had less odious problems. But in general, I think it was an awful thing to do.
Yes.
And a lot of people say that it caused great harm among Native people, because then these children would come back home and they no longer could speak the language that their parents spoke, and their parents didn't speak English, and things started breaking down. Mm-hmm. And the irony is to me that because of casinos now, those casinos that make any money, one of their big projects is language immersion programs. So they are funding programs by which Native people are trying to relearn the languages that were really ripped from their throats.
Mm-hmm. Ironies abound.
Yes,
here,
they do. They do, yes.
But you wonder why anyone would ever have thought it was a good idea to set up that system.
Actually, there are so many bad policies in U.S. history about Native people. In almost every one, I think you can find some kernel of a rationale that they would convince you makes it seem like it's really a good idea, that we are doing this for them. And they'll do much better if they're more like us, and that is more like European Americans. And in general, it just was not the case. I think it can be shown that a lot of people thought, yes, this is a good thing. The same way with missionary schools. And they thought, we're doing this for your own good. There's a famous expression, kill the Indian and save the man. That was made by a man who ran one of these boarding schools. So in general, I think they thought this was a good idea. I don't know why. They hadn't thought it through, really, obviously. And I think generally it wasn't a good idea. Some people said, oh, it was fine, we got a good education. I mean, there are individual stories of people who say they thrived, they prospered. But it just pointed out the clash between Native culture and non-Native culture,
yes,
which was huge.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in Kansas, and I was aware of the Haskell Indian Institute there. But I always thought, what a fine thing, because, of course, I didn't know anything about it. And perhaps by the time I was aware of it, I hoped that it had changed a bit for the best.
An awful lot of people went to Haskell. It's one of the most famous of the boarding schools.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, it's said to be a great place of renewal. And so it is basically a tribal college. And people go there and try to restore what they lost.
Oh, that's encouraging.
And yet there are, according to someone I know who went there, there still are senses of the ghosts of the past.
Of course.
But it's now something entirely different.
That's interesting.
But it was one of the worst places, one of the first two.
Mm-hmm. Another problem that you addressed that cropped up in a number of the interviews, repatriation. Mm-hmm. Of the artifacts, which are so precious to the tribe and are stolen from them and turn up in museums, which want to hang on to them.
Yes, I know. And that's another word that is well known to virtually all Native American adults, repatriation. And most non-Native adults have no idea what it means, or they think it, it has something to do with immigration, maybe.
Yes.
And it essentially means giving back to the tribes articles that were not necessarily even stolen, but bought from people. And not only artifacts, but bones. And the bones, I would say, are the most emotionally laden objects that museums have. It's also, of course, difficult to tell whose bones a museum has. So it gets very, very, very complicated. One of my stories involves an Ojibwe woman who is in charge of repatriation for her tribe. And she explains the whole process. It's a federal law now. You have to, as a museum, if you get federal money, you have to explain that these are the items that we have, and you have to let the tribes know about them, and they go over them to see if there is something that is theirs, and they can ask for it back. It's a long, long process. I mean, it can take years. You have to be very certain of your facts. And of course, most of these objects were not signed, but there are other indications of whose they were just because of the design or the place where they were located. It's a fractious argument, and it's a fractious area. And the woman I interviewed, this Ojibwe woman, said, museums say, oh, we'll lose all our displays and we'll have nothing left in our display cases. And she says, that's just ridiculous. They have so many things that they don't know where they came from anyway, so they wouldn't be repatriated. And she said, we have nothing against lending them back to you if you want to put them on display.
Mm-hmm. But imagine if you identified something as your grandmother's beadwork and the museum people said, prove it. I mean, that's it's such a slap.
And she, in fact, talked about going to the Heard Museum in Arizona and with a tribal elder who said, oh, that's the cradle board that my grandmother made or that my mother made. And the Heard won't give it back because it wasn't communally owned. It was privately owned by this one family. Mm-hmm. That's in the aspect of the law that's kind of complicated.
It seemed to me that it's a characteristic of the nones who make the laws to move the goalposts a lot. And change the rules, and oops, they slipped through on that one, so let's close that door. And it's just, you know, as you read these stories, you think, how can the Native people possibly have a sense of humor and have a cheerfulness to, I know there's a great deal of depression, and you certainly bring this out, but many of the people you talk to have this wonderful acceptance of adversity. Well, they've certainly had lots of practice. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think they are not, of course, the only people who find gallows humor as a way to get through the day or to get through life. So I think that's maybe a universal human trait. But when I began this, I had no idea that they were just so funny. And almost everybody was very, very funny. For instance, I'm a vegetarian, and virtually everybody said, well, in my native language, and it didn't matter what native language it was because it was just a joke anyway, they said, you know, how vegetarian translates, it means bad hunter. So there were just silly things like that. And they referred to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the BIA, as saying that it really refers to bossing Indians around. And then they tease each other mercilessly.
Yeah.
And they laugh and tease. I mean, actually, I think of humor as pretty much an American trait. I'm sure other countries think that they're also very funny. But I think that is an American trait, is humor. And Native people are Americans. I mean, they're Native Americans, but they're also American Americans.
Yes.
And they laugh like everybody else. Mm-hmm. Corny jokes, lousy jokes. Gallows humor, you name it. They're laughing about it. It was a great treat.
Yeah. I was impressed with Henry Frank, who is probably in San Quentin for life for something that he should never have been sent to prison at all. And the way that he's made a life for himself within the parameters that he didn't seek but were laid on him.
I'm glad you brought up Henry Frank. He's one of the most interesting people in the book.
Yes.
And I sometimes think that if this book does anything, I hope it will encourage a pro bono lawyer with time on his or her hands to take up Henry Frank's case.
Yes.
He is a Yurok Indian who was in a gang in Eureka, and he drove a car past a shopping mall from which a passenger in his car shot and wounded a man for being Asian. It was a revenge shooting. Henry maintains he didn't know anyone in his car had a gun. The man, as far as I know, recovered. He lost his spleen, but otherwise recovered. In fact, I think I found him on Google, and he's got a full-time job, and he's okay. Henry had a lawyer whom I interviewed who said, if you do a plea bargain to this or this or this, which is the problem was also driving away from the scene of the crime and also not ratting on his co-gang members, the man said, you can get out in 7 years. Henry was persuaded by the lawyer for the shooter not to take a plea bargain, but to throw their case to the jury. The jury threw the book at him, and Henry is in jail for 29 to life for having driven this car from which a man was wounded and got out. And the plea bargain would have had him out about a decade ago. He went in when he was 19. He's now 35. Actually, he's no longer in San Quentin. He was transferred to Corcoran for the crime of good behavior, basically. They wanted his cell in San Quentin, and they put him in one of these very crowded dormitories in Corcoran. So that makes it much harder for his family to see him, and it also makes it harder for him to have any kind of art program, which they had at San Quentin.
Yeah.
So it's quite a story. There's a greater rate of incarceration among Native people than among others, so I thought I wanted to talk to someone who had been in prison, and a few local organizations. Insight Prison Project was one, led me to him.
Mm-hmm. I hope that people reading this book will not only have an awareness of Native people and their individuality and their begin to get that, have that come into focus, but that some will be moved to address these injustices.
I would like very specifically for someone to volunteer to help Henry Frank's case. But I also would like the general reader just to know that Native people are around.
Yes.
And it would be nice also if the book might be useful for legislators.
Yes.
And for others who have positions of power who have really no idea about Native people at all or that there is a Native culture. A lot of these people are not on reservations. I think
yes.
Now apparently about 3/4 of people live off reservations, of Natives live off reservation. So it's not necessarily a case of getting better infrastructure to Native reservations, which is certainly needed, but it's more just a case of respect and acknowledgement. I'd say that's what I really hope people will get from this, that a recognition that Native people are around us,
yes.
And they might even be invisible. In fact, many of them say they're invisible to us. I'd say that when a non-Native person walks down a street and sees a Native person, they might not know it's a Native person. They might think this person is Hispanic or maybe part Asian or maybe white or black or who knows, or any kind of melting pot mixture. But unless you know that this is a Native person and you're thinking of this, or you may maybe notice someone's wearing turquoise earrings or something, you wouldn't necessarily know that these are Native people.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, I think, most non-Native people have never knowingly even met a Native person.
Right.
And they're missing a lot.
While I was reading your book, I went to hear an Arlo Guthrie concert. So here we all are in Annalee High School in Sebastopol singing away, "This Land is Your Land," and thinking about Woody Guthrie. I thought, wait a minute. What am I singing? This isn't my land. We stole this land.
Well, actually, Native people do have a version of that, which is, "This land was our land, and now it's your land."
And in Canada, you know, where they're called First Nation, in the National Anthem of Canada, which is ever so much more successful than ours, when you come to the phrase our home and native land, if you listen closely, there are people who are singing it, our home on native land, which I think is a very nice way of just slipping a little something in, saying, mm-hmm. folks, we were not here first.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me how native people are just overlooked. And I really think it's causing some discord in this country. I really do think that part of the many social problems we have in this country is that we don't necessarily recognize where we are. And I say this in the conclusion, I really wish people would think, okay, the place where I work, where I worship, where I play, where I live, this was Coastal Miwok, or this was Maidu, or this was Pomo Land, or wherever it was, just at least know who was here first. Maybe know a little something about why they left. People who are so proud of being pioneer families. Native people weren't so crazy about the 49ers and what happened, and that was pretty much decimated lots of California tribes, the 49ers and all the prospectors. I think we should at least just know it, and also maybe not to kowtow and to assume every Native person is some holy person and better than anybody else in terms of moral stature, but maybe just get a sense of where they came from and what's important to them and see if this could be appropriated by non-Natives as a way of life, including not taking too much, not being greedy, being happy with what you have. I think there are a lot of things that traditional Native culture can teach us, and I think an awful lot of Native people today, at least those I met, are trying very much to connect with what they had and welcoming in, actually, other people who might want to listen. What surprises me is that Native people, in many instances, tried so hard to accommodate these strangers among them. And I don't know that, in general, non-Native people reciprocated. They reciprocated in terms of iconography, oh, what beautiful blankets, what beautiful music, whatever. Let's use your word for a helicopter and cities and cars. But I don't think, in general, non-Native America really appreciated Native America, and I don't think they appreciate Native Americans today, but they're here.
Yeah. Well, I think that the work you've done for the last 10 years in putting this beautiful book together is going to place your readers on a different path, and I certainly encourage people to get your hands on this book.
Thank you, Rosemary.
Allison, it's so good of you to come in. And would you mention your website, please? Because you have a spectacular website.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's very cleverly named, AllisonOwings.com. That's it. Allison with one L, AllisonOwings.com. That's my website.
Yes. And the book is Indian Voices, Listening to Native Americans. It's by Allison Owings, published by Rutgers University in 2011. It's in the library, it's in the bookstores, it's online. Go get a copy of this book because you will be so glad that you read it.
Rosemary Manchester, speaking with Allison Owings. Tonight's show featured Chuck Kensler, Vicki Reno, John Trudell from his spoken word album, Descendant, Not Ancestor. The music of Jan Michael Looking Wolf and Joanne Shenandoah. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. Join us next month. It's a novel idea.